at the conclusion of episode 116, which was titled The Rationalist Part 2, I promised that we would come back to the Enlightenment and examine what it actually did to theology and church history. That time has come. And it's worth coming back to because in many ways, and perhaps the most significant way, the church today, at least the modern church in the Western world, lives inside of a world that the Enlightenment built. Classic Western civilization descended from Jerusalem. It was the product of a Christian worldview that gave us universities, hospitals, the abolition of slavery, and a concept of human dignity that's rooted in the Imago Dei. But the modern West has been steadily co-opted by a secular worldview descended from Athens. It's living off the fumes of a fuel tank that was filled by Christianity, and the needle is getting pretty close to empty. So let's pick up that philosophical thread. In our earlier episode, we spent time with the empiricist David Hume, whose skepticism was so thoroughgoing that he called into question the common sense notion of cause and effect itself. Hume's argument was essentially this: all we can legitimately talk about is what we experience. Just because one thing has followed another 1,000 times before doesn't allow us to say with certainty that it will follow again. We can't derive universal laws from repeated experience because experience is always particular. It's never universal. The sun has risen every morning of recorded history, but that, Hume says, doesn't prove it's going to rise tomorrow. That wasn't a mere philosophical parlor game that he was playing. The effect of Hume's argument was to cast doubt on reason itself as a reliable guide to truth. And that, of course, created a crisis. The rationalists had been building an entire worldview on reason's ability to unlock reality. Hume had just sawn off the branch that they were sitting on. He did not go unanswered, though. One of his most significant challengers was a fellow Scotsman named Thomas Reed. Born in 1710, Reed was a Presbyterian minister before becoming a professor at King's College in Aberdeen, where in 1764 he published his landmark work. It was titled An Inquiry into the Human Mind on the Principles of Common Sense. Reed's argument was elegant in its simplicity. He said that Hume and his predecessors had made a fundamental error. They assumed that if a belief couldn't be justified by philosophical argument, it wasn't justified at all. Reed disagreed. He argued there is a category of self-evident knowledge, what he called first principles, or common sense, that we are automatically justified in trusting. We don't need a chain of logical deductions to believe that the external world exists, that our senses give us genuine information about it, or that cause and effect are real. These are the bedrock assumptions without which thought itself can't even get started. You've heard of Reed's position, even if you haven't heard his name. It came to be known as common sense philosophy, or more formally, Scottish common sense realism. It had a remarkable influence, particularly in America, where it shaped the thinking of theologians at Princeton Seminary and became something like the philosophical air that the 19th century American evangelical Christians breathed. So the next time you hear someone say, well, just use your common sense, they are, whether they know it or not, downstream from Thomas Reed. Also in France during this period, the Baron de Montesquieu was applying the principles of reason to government. His conclusion was that a republic was the superior form of political organization because, as he put it, power tends to corrupt those who use it, though hold it. His proposed solution, dividing government into 3 co-equal branches that would balance and check each other, became the architectural blueprint for both the American and French constitutions, though he proposed it some 30 years before either nation adopted it. Shortly after Montesquieu, Jean-Jacques Rousseau arrived to complicate the Enlightenment's story. The Enlightenment had generally told a triumphalist narrative about history. The idea was, you know, humanity was marching forward from primitive superstition to rational sophistication. Progress was the watchword. Well, Rousseau looked at that narrative and said, not so fast. What you're calling progress, he argued, is actually a departure from humanity's natural state, an artificial and alienating departure at that. He romanticized the noble savage, living in uncorrupted freedom, untangled from the conventions and complications of modern civilization. Government, he insisted, should serve rather than rule, and no one had the right to impose their beliefs on anyone else. And there's a certain irony in Rousseau, which I trust you've already parsed out. Having declared that no one can tell anyone else what to believe, he proceeded to declare that the irreducible minimum of belief is that God exists, the soul is immortal, and moral norms bind all people together universally. So, Rousseau's rule turned out to be, believe whatever you want as long as it agrees with me. It's a contradiction that lives on in every generation of skeptics who insist with great confidence that certainty is certainly impossible. At the end of the 18th century, a German philosopher arrived who didn't just complicate the Enlightenment project, he detonated it. Most historians of philosophy regard Immanuel Kant as a central figure of the entire modern period. The philosopher Bertrand Russell, no friend to Christianity, conceded that Kant was perhaps the most important philosopher since Aristotle. That's not universally agreed to, but it gives you the scale of the man. Now, I should confess something before we go any further. I can't understand Kant. I say that with the pun fully intended. Every time I think that I've got a handle on Kantian philosophy, he says something that makes it all just slip away again. My goal as a teacher is to make things clearer, not murkier. Kant's goal was also clarity. But he simply operated in an altitude where the air is very thin. Now, I'm going to do my best, leaning on how others have explained him. Kant was born in 1724 in Königsberg, Prussia. It was a city on the southeastern shore of the Baltic Sea. It was cosmopolitan enough to serve as a commercial and intellectual hub while remaining geographically remote from the great capitals of Europe. His family were pietists. Regular subscribers know that pietism was an evangelical renewal movement within German Lutheranism. It stressed conversion, dependence on divine grace, personal Bible study, and a deeply felt inner religious life. It was, in many respects, the German cousin of the Puritan and Methodist movements that we've discussed in earlier episodes. Now, Kant's parents were genuinely devout, and his mother, in particular, made a lasting impression on him. He remembered her throughout his life with deep affection, crediting her with planting the first seeds of intellectual curiosity in him. Well, he entered the University of Königsberg at 16, eventually studying under a professor named Martin Knudsen, who introduced him to both the philosophy of Leibniz and the physics of Isaac Newton. And it turns out that the combination was formative for Kant. When his father died in 1746, Kant left the university and spent nearly a decade as a private tutor to the families of the Königsberg countryside. He continued to read and to think all the time. He was, by all accounts, a solid student, but hardly what we would call a prodigy. What made Kant remarkable was not an early brilliance, but decades of sustained, relentless intellectual labor. His Critique of Pure Reason, published in 1781 when Kant was 57 years old, it was the product of roughly 10 years of meditation. He published it reluctantly, uncertain whether he'd expressed himself clearly. History's verdict has been that he had not, in fact, expressed himself clearly, but that what he was saying was world-altering nonetheless. Kant described himself as having been a committed rationalist until he read Hume and was awakened from my dogmatic slumber. It's one of the most famous phrases in philosophy. Hume's skepticism had knocked out the easy confidence that reason could simply think its way to universal truth. Kant decided to find out what reason could actually do, and equally importantly, what it could not. His answer, in simplified form, is this. There's no such thing as purely objective knowledge in the way the rationalists imagined. Oh, but there are fixed structures in the human mind that organize all of our experiences. He called the most fundamental of these time and space. Not things that we perceive in the world, but the frameworks through which we process our perceptions. Now, beyond these, he proposed 12 categories of understanding. Some of them were causality, unity, quantity, necessity. Every experience we get is sorted and shaped by these mental structures before it becomes intelligible to us. Here's an illustration that might help. Imagine you and I are standing on a black sand beach at sunset. The sky is running through a full palette of color, indigo fading to scarlet, scarlet bleeding into gold. So I point at the sky and I say, hey, look at that orange. And you nod and say, oh, that's a beautiful orange. But how could we ever know that whether what I experience as orange is the same as what you experience as orange? We've both been taught to apply the label orange to a particular stimulus. But the inner experience, the qualia, as philosophers refer to it, might be completely different between us. My orange could be your blue, and we would never know. Kant's point is that what we know isn't the things as they actually are in themselves. What we know is the things as our minds have processed and organized them. The thing in itself, what Kant called the noumenon, remains permanently inaccessible. What we experience is always the phenomenon, the thing as filtered through our mental structures. The theological consequences were enormous. If existence is simply one of the mind's categories for organizing experience, rather than an objective feature of reality out there waiting to be discovered, then the classical philosophical proofs for the existence of God collapse. You can't reason your way to God from experience because experience only ever gives you phenomena, not ultimate reality. The ontological argument, the cosmological argument, the teleological argument, all the great rational demonstrations that had been built up over centuries, Kant declared were off limits to pure reason. But Kant, like most Enlightenment thinkers, was reluctant to simply walk away from God entirely. In his Critique of Practical Reason, published in 1788, he argued that while pure speculative reason cannot prove God's existence, practical reason, the realm of the moral life, requires certain assumptions, including God, freedom, and the immortality of the soul. You can't make sense of the moral life, he argued, without them. So he tried to salvage religion by relocating it from the head to the will, from metaphysics to morality. The problem was that this concession had the shelf life of a sandcastle at high tide. Once the next generation of thinkers absorbed the lesson that pure reason had been declared incompetent in matters of God and the soul, the practical reason safety net looked increasingly like what critics called it, philosophical training wheels for those not quite ready to embrace full secular rationalism. And one by one, those wheels came off. Theologians in the generation after Kant largely accepted his divorce of faith and reason. Many concluded that since you couldn't argue your way to God, the proper domain of religion was merely feeling, experience, the inner life. Friedrich Schleiermacher, often called the father of modern liberal theology, relocated the essence of religion to a feeling of absolute dependence. It sounds almost pietist. But where pietism kept its emotional life tethered to scripture and the historic creeds, Schleiermacher's move effectively unmoored theology from objective truth altogether. And from there, as later episodes will trace, it was a relatively short journey to the full-scale theological liberalism of the 19th century, a project that decided Christianity had to conform to the scientific and intellectual consensus of the modern age or become irrelevant. The result, as we've seen across denominations that made that bargain, was not relevance. It was slow institutional death. Now, Kant didn't intend any of that. He was, by many accounts, a genuinely religious man in his own complicated way. But ideas have consequences, and Kant's ideas had enormous ones. Here's where this story gets interesting for us as Christians. Because the Christian tradition has resources for responding to Kant that neither the rationalist nor the pure empiricists had, we don't need to prove God from nature alone because we have revelation. We don't need unaided human reason to build the bridge to ultimate reality because ultimate reality became flesh and dwelt among us. The incarnation is philosophy's answer to Kant. God did not wait for us to reason our way to him. He came to us. We'll pick up the theological fallout in next episodes.